This episode is an exclusive insight into the views of the Elgium investment team on what's happening in markets and what this means for investors. This podcast is intended for investment professionals, and if you're enjoying Elgium Talks, why not subscribe in your Apple Podcasts or Spotify app and never miss another episode.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from Elgium. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Ed Wicks, Head of Trading, and Guy Whitby-Smith, Head of Solutions Portfolio Management. Quick note on housekeeping before we get started. This is our last weekly call. From next month, we'll be moving to a fortnightly basis, reflecting the somewhat slower pace of developments in the pandemic. That said, news is still flowing thick and fast with important implications for our clients. On that note, Sonia, could you please give us an update on the state of markets and the health of the global economy?
Of course, Max, thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. As always, I hope you're joining us well and healthy. So absolutely, last week has been quite eventful again, and we had actually quite market-friendly news making the rounds. There was lots of talks around potential vaccines, and we've obviously now have quite a large number of international drug makers that are in the race to develop a vaccine. That clearly has been positive, and alongside this, we had further announcements from governments around the world on lifting lockdown restrictions. We've had some news around the Premier League here in the UK. You know, the Bundesliga is up and running in Germany. So there's been more and more news flow that makes us feel a bit more normal than before. And then last but not least, we obviously had the announcement from Ursula von der Leyen on the EU Recovery Fund, which again has been quite a positive statement. I know we are lacking detail yet, but it is clear that in terms of the symbolism, that has been very well received. Now, on the negative side, we will talk a bit more around the U.S.-China tensions and the very controversial security law that China has been imposing on Hong Kong, and obviously then the U.S. reacting to this, declaring that the former British colony is no longer autonomous from mainland China. So lots going on, not only virus-related, but you can see that geopolitics are very much creeping back into our agenda, and as such, we need to think about further ahead in terms of those implications. Now, as usual, coming back to the virus developments and using the slides that we have provided here, you see very nicely we have created a new slide, which I think is very nice in telling the story about the initial waves that have been developing. You see very clearly China, Hong Kong obviously being the first hotbed and is the small blue part there in the beginning, then very clearly being taken over by developed markets, which you can very neatly see now is slowly fading. And now, very worryingly, you see the third wave really emerging in the emerging markets. And although we have talked about this before, and you know that we are witnessing a lot lower level of fatalities, it is yet very worrying if you look at the slide right now in front of you to see developments in Brazil really getting out of hand, and the numbers coming out of Brazil very much resembling those that we have witnessed in the developed markets. So clearly not yet out of the woods, and we're watching very carefully that obviously with the lifting of restrictions in the developed world, we should expect at least an increase of new infections, although for the time being, it's been quite a positive backdrop. And if you look at markets, that clearly has been reflected, because hence there's the expectation that we can write off the second quarter, we can write off all the negativity when it comes to the economic data and look forward to the third and fourth quarter. Now, if we think about obviously vaccines, they still seem to be quite remote, and experts are still warning that a vaccine normally takes 12 to 18 months to develop, and this should not be any different this time around. And hence, there has been more focus on studies in terms of what can help through the lifting of restrictions. And we found new evidence that actually wearing face masks is an important driver to keep new infections down. As we know, Asia is very much used to wearing face masks in public, and you see on the slide right in front of you, that clearly even in Asia we have seen an uplift in the use of face masks in public, but we have likewise seen a dramatic increase across the US, Germany and France. But you can see very clearly that in the UK this is not yet the case. So we are anticipating that there will be further announcements from the government, because there's sufficient scientific evidence that this can help break the virus spreading. Now, with regards to the economic update, it has been kind of business as usual in terms of the economic data. There has not been any major negative or positive surprises. We're still obviously going through earnings season. And again, most companies at this point have probably moved away from giving clearer guidance, because at this point it is still very unclear to most how the future will develop. But what we have seen, and this is very interestingly, that we have seen a lot more in terms of capital raisings. We know the bond market has been very active very early on, particularly in the US, but we have now seen a flurry of capital and equity capital raisings in the UK and Europe, and we would expect more of this in due course. Now, with regards to our activity trackers, it's so far behaving as we would expect. We're using high-frequency data to think about the trajectory of particularly the U.S. economy, and the same here in Europe. And so far, it is very much in line with our scenarios. And we would assume, if there's no further major second wave, that the picture and the trajectory that we have mapped here is a good guide for future economic activity. We have talked about inflation in the past, and we have warned that the immediate impact from the pandemic would be a negative inflationary, a deflationary shock. And you see very clearly here that the impact has been quite dramatic, as expected. If you bring the economy to a standstill, then obviously the impact on prices has to be negative. And we've highlighted obviously the most important factors that have been driving inflation downwards. And I know Guy Whitby-Smith will pick up the inflationary topic later on, because that clearly is an important point in our analysis and how we think about the portfolio positioning. Now, I would like to spend a bit more on the geopolitical events, because it's very clear that we had quite a few of these unfolding over the last week or so. None of the points that we are raising here on this slide are new. Everything that is here has been discussed before, but obviously with the pandemic fading a little bit and economies slowly getting back to normal, it's clear that those events will resurface, and surely we have had quite a lot of news flow on all of these. There's two mildly negative, or put it this way, one very negative, one mildly negative, and then the Eurozone sustainability, I think, has been a surprising event. And we have a slide here which has been set up before we had the announcement from Ursula von der Leyen yesterday. Again, you can see that the data we have used were based on original anticipated data points and leaked documents. The actual announcement yesterday was more positive, because in fact we're not talking about 500 billion euros, but 750 billion euros. And it's interesting that it will be a mix of grants and loans. And so overall the size has been perceived positively. Another very positive fact is that these measures will be supported by joint issuance of bonds. And again, it's a big step forward, and this is why I highlighted earlier the symbolism from this deal is probably even higher than the actual effects of the amounts. And we don't have all the details yet, but it's clear that these would be sufficient measures to support the periphery alongside the core, and that obviously there's a very strong kind of focus on the unity and making sure that this is taking care of the Eurozone overall. You can see here that Italian spreads have reacted very positively. That was probably the core area of concern, and we are below 200 basis points in terms of Italian spreads over German bonds. Before I move on to markets again, it's worth going back to the geopolitical events and obviously the US-China relations that clearly have soured over the past week. And there's big question marks now on the implication for Hong Kong as a global financial center. It's very clear that Hong Kong now has moved into the center of the tensions between the US and China. and China has been very clear that they are no longer accepting any dissidents, and the law, in fact, is very similar to what has been imposed in mainland China. We've discussed about the resurfacing U.S.-China tensions in previous calls, and this is an, a worsening of the tension, and we are now waiting to see how this continues, particularly with the stance from the U.S. that Hong Kong no longer is autonomous from mainland China, and as such, obviously, it would allow the U.S. to impose sanctions on individuals within Hong Kong. Lastly, on Brexit, again, we have briefly touched on this last week. No new news in the meantime, other than the fact that obviously the deadline is approaching fast to ask for an extension for the transition period. That for the time being does not seem to be the case that the UK will ask for it. And so we are very much gearing ourselves for a very hot summer and autumn in terms of discussions. This obviously we should be put in the context that if there were a second wave of infections, we would have to assume that the government's capacity to deal with both still the pandemic and Brexit would be very limited, so clearly one to watch out for. So in terms of markets, they clearly have bought more into the positive news story around the easing of lockdown restrictions and the potential for the development of a vaccine. And as such, it's very much looking through the really bad economic data that we are still getting, and obviously taking some confidence from the high frequency data, and similarly looking at the developments of these. And as you can see on the current slide, asset markets and assets have actually recovered very much in line with their risk profile. So you clearly see that equities overall still down 16%. I would caveat the equity bit very much, because obviously we have seen a very strong divergence among equities, regions and sectors. We still have a very strong growth versus value trend in place. So what you're seeing here clearly is the average. But you see likewise that obviously in terms of credit, high yield, EMD, all themes that we have covered in previous calls have behaved very much as we would have expected. So with that, I would like to hand back to Max.
Well, thank you, Sonia, for walking us through those shifting market and macro dynamics. Let's move to Ed now. Ed, you've written on the Elgin blog about how far we've come from the days of traders shouting and gesticulating on trading floors, but continuous interaction with colleagues and counterparties is still crucial to what you do, as well as access to a wide variety of information and systems. So how has the global trading team navigated the transition to working from home?
Well, morning, everyone, and thank you for the question, Max. I think the first thing to say is that the global trading team has really moved to a remote setup pretty seamlessly. That is to say, we have 31 traders now working remotely in Hong Kong, London, and Chicago. I probably should note, actually, that in a pre-COVID world, if anyone can remember that far back, Elgin traders were not permitted to routinely trade from home. So this was quite a large undertaking for both myself and the team. So what did we do? Well, ahead of lockdown, we took steps to ensure that all traders had appropriate equipment and connectivity to safely trade from home. Hardware was sent to every trader's home address so that everyone in the team had a uniform setup to work effectively in a remote environment. I guess in practice, this meant that Elgin sent out items such as laptops, docking stations, keyboards, etc., as well as super large screens to ensure each trader could log in and work effectively. We also rolled out a virtual telephony solution, which meant that all trading-related phone calls could be appropriately recorded. So from that perspective, I think we've managed really well, and I really should credit our technology teams for the incredible work that they've done in supporting us through this period. I think another challenge that we face, and Max alluded to it, is communication. So in a work-from-home environment, how do you keep in touch and communicate effectively with colleagues? Here, I think we're very fortunate that messaging and video conferencing technology has developed so much in recent years. I mean, an important part of every Elgin trader's role is being able to communicate effectively with portfolio managers, as well as other stakeholders. And I think if I look at the tools that we're using today, it's things like Microsoft Teams and Zoom and all these type of applications, and they've really, really helped us stay in touch whilst we've been working remotely. The final challenge really that I've identified that I'll share with you today concerns staffing, and in particular, new joiners. How do you cope when you have new traders joining the team in this environment? And I think one thing that's worked really well here for us is what we call our buddy system. So whenever a new trader joins our team, they're given a buddy who will be an experienced member of the group. To me, I mean, this has been even more important during this 4 or 5 months than ever before. And in addition, we've been able to leverage existing technology. So all of our new joiners that are coming into the team, we're able to give them very bespoke, conservative trading limits on the activity that they're able to execute. And it's things like that that really give me sufficient comfort to allow them to commence trading very small orders initially in a risk-controlled fashion.
Right, well, staying with that theme, Ed, you've witnessed some extraordinary moments in markets in recent months. What were the most striking, and how have you coped with the sheer volume of business?
So, I should say at the outset, I mean, I've been in trading roles all of my working life, and I can certainly say that I've seen some incredibly interesting periods. Obviously, we had the GFC in 08, the Brexit vote, to name but a few. But even having been in the industry for so many years, I could honestly say I don't think I've seen anything quite like March and April this year. So, I mean, I'll try and put that into some context. So firstly, if I look at equity markets, in March, we really saw the most volatile period in the history of the S&P index, which is just phenomenal, just to say that sentence. We saw astonishing daily average moves of 5%. These are huge numbers for the blue chip index like the S&P. Equally, in fixed income markets, we also saw huge stress. For example, the volatility that we saw around the Tradeweb close was extreme at times, with double-digit basis point moves. You know, these are incredible statistics that we're witnessing. And of course, alongside that spike in volatility, we also had to cater for significant changes in liquidity conditions, particularly of course, in bond markets. So how did we cope? Well, there's a couple of things I'll try and draw out to explain my thinking. First of all, I think we were very adaptable. And what do I mean by that? Well, we didn't just carry on as normal. We saw the changing in conditions very early on, and we altered our execution arrangements where it made sense. For example, in instruments like investment-grade bonds, we reduced our usage of automated trading solutions, whilst in other markets, such as take the futures markets, we reduced our execution window for the quarterly March rolls. So that's just a couple of examples to try and draw out the fact that we saw the changing conditions and we were able to adapt to them rather than just continuing as normal. I think another way that we were able to get through this period was to rely on the close PM trader relationships that we have at Elgin. We always work, you know, very, very closely, hand in glove, PMs and traders communicating throughout the day. But I would say that during these 4 or 5 months, we've closened that relationship even further. And this has helped to ensure that we receive benchmark orders earlier than usual, and that gives us the longest execution window possible, so that's a good thing. And equally, if there's discretion on the timing of an order, then traders have been able to provide a good deal of input to ensure that all the liquidity opportunities are being made use of. So importantly, in things like fixed income, that would be including making sure portfolio managers are aware of the liquidity impact of various central bank actions. And then finally, I think another aspect that we've leaned on is the scale of our business, and that's really helped us navigate this crisis well. An advantage of this scale is the ability to cross contra flows, so buys and sells together. It's a very important source of liquidity, and it's obviously one that we were very focused on during this period. To give just perhaps one metric on that, to put it into perspective, in sterling investment grade credit, so far this year, we've been able to cross 15% of our notional turnover. And that gives us a huge advantage. So hopefully that gives you a bit of an insight into how we approach this challenging period. And just to finish with one statistic that I'm particularly proud of, and it really highlights how the team has coped so far this year. I looked at the numbers recently, and at the end of April, the global trading team had executed more than 2.3 trillion sterling in notional turnover, which represents a 33% increase year on year. So I think that really shows how we've coped as a team and an organization.
Thanks, Ed, for that insight, which was reassuring and colorful. Let's turn to Guy now. Guy, it's been nearly 2 months since you were last on the call. Ed has just outlined some of the very unusual market moves we've seen. What have been the major challenges experienced by LDI strategies over this period?
Yes, thanks, Max. Yes, absolutely. As Ed referred to, March was an exceptionally turbulent period in the markets. And I guess on the LDI side, you know, the UK government bonds were very similarly, very much caught up in this storm. I mean, we saw sharp rises in gilt yields, increasing by about 1% in just a few days, and index-linked gilt yields similarly rising sharply, reaching three-year highs. I mean, this had potential to cause collateral issues for highly leveraged LDI strategies, as this move higher in yields triggered collateral calls on leveraged gilt and swap positions. It's also, in addition, FX hedges and synthetic equity positions, these also experienced collateral calls due to falls in both sterling and the equity markets. I guess this really highlighted the importance of having a robust and also holistic risk management framework. And by collateralizing all these positions in a combined way, this reduced the overall collateral strain in portfolios and made coordination much more straightforward. I guess in addition, the other thing I'd call out is we've seen an increased use of collateral waterfall arrangements, where a scheme specifies in advance other funds that can be drawn on if needed, therefore allowing for much quicker reallocation of funds to meet collateral calls if required. And this really worked well and acted as another way to protect schemes from these sorts of extreme market dislocations when we were getting, you know, some of the biggest collateral calls we'd seen in recent history due to the large market moves that we've been chatting about on this call. We also saw in the funding market, government bonds came under stress with repo rates spiking towards the end of March. This was really driven by a combination of factors, reduced risk appetite from banks, general market illiquidity, and sort of the usual quarter-end balance sheet pressures. We saw policymakers respond to alleviate these pressures. Bank of England launched additional repo facilities. The US regulator relaxed leverage ratio rules. And this combined with the passing of the quarter as we moved into April meant the repo market has now since returned to more normal levels, although it's still more elevated than it was sort of pre-COVID. Again, this really highlights the risks of having too much repo exposure in an LDI portfolio rolling in any single period, as these stress conditions can often last for quite a few weeks, resulting in much higher funding costs for any positions needing to be rolled during this period. And certainly, we aim to spread sort of repo roll dates throughout the year, really to minimise the risk and to reduce the amount our portfolios were impacted by this.
Well, thanks for that, Guy. What are the potential future implications for LDI strategies of the issues you've just outlined?
Yeah, I guess, yeah, we've certainly, as we've sort of passed the peak crisis in the markets in March and early April, we're sort of having a bit more time to be thinking about how these recent experiences, and COVID-19 in particular, I guess will impact sort of future LDI strategies. I mean, in the near term at least, I think one thing we can be sure of is we're going to get much more government debt issuance and much larger fiscal deficits. While this sort of higher gilt issuance should in theory mean that we'd see some upward pressure on gilt yields, I guess potentially seeing some of the rises in yields that we saw a couple of months ago, well, in practice, the continued support from central banks, I think we expect rates to continue to be pinned down at very low levels. And indeed, almost the opposite. In the UK, quite recently, the Bank of England has recently started talking openly about the possibility of negative interest rates here in the UK. The previous governor, Mark Carney, was very much opposed to taking rates through zero. But Andrew Bailey is much more open to this concept. I guess while just talk at this stage, and I think we feel that a near-term focus is likely to remain on quantitative easing, it does feel much more likely now that we'll see interest rates go negative in the UK in the future, especially if we see a deep global recession following this pandemic. I guess that will have really quite profound impacts on UK pension schemes and on LDI strategies in general. Gilt yields are now negative out to 2 years, and last week in the UK the government issued a three-year bond with a negative yield, which was the first for the UK. Mm. So some small centres have already got negative rates. I guess this really does act as a reminder that while interest rates are certainly very low, they're still considerably higher than even just looking across the channel compared to German yields, where we're almost 1% higher in yields. So there remains substantial downside risk to interest rates in the future.
We've only got a few minutes left now, so let's just have a couple of quick-fire questions. Ed, in light of the challenges we've discussed, how are you positioning the team in the weeks and months going forward?
Yeah, so I guess there's a couple of things that we're really focused on. So number one would be ensuring that we continue to leverage our global model efficiently. That's to say that making sure that we load balance the volume that's coming through the desk in the correct manner. And really, you know, the value of having traders across multiple locations was evident this year. One of the things that it gives us is truly access to the deepest possible pools of liquidity. So definitely be focusing on the global aspect of our business. I think secondly, it's going to be important to push ahead with our trading technology program. So just updating our systems, ensuring that we're absolutely benefiting from all the functionality that is available. And I don't think anyone would say that this crisis is going away anytime soon. And so this is really crucial, because in a liquidity-starved environment where everything naturally takes longer for people to do, you want your traders focused on the value-add activity. So that's really important for us. And then maybe finally, the other thing that I'm focused on is our trading research team. So this crisis, and before this crisis, but certainly in the last 4 or 5 months, it's highlighted the importance of good, really good data and the ability to interpret that data. And some of the studies that our trading research team have provided have been really interesting. And I guess crucially, what they've been able to do is to help us improve trading outcomes for our clients. So those are some of the aspects I think I'm going to be focusing on in the coming months.
Right, well, thanks for that. Guy, as flagged by Sonia earlier, and this is a question from one of our clients, how are you approaching inflation hedging given the low levels of implied inflation, proposed changes to RPI indexation in the UK, and uncertainty over the longer-term outlook?
Yes, absolutely. I'm just conscious of time, so I'll try and keep it brief. But yes, we've certainly seen, obviously, inflation has fallen substantially, particularly in the UK, over the last 12 months. I guess ordinarily we'd say that this created a good opportunity to increase levels of inflation hedging and inflation hedge ratios for pension schemes. You can now hedge at levels sort of cheaper than where we've seen RPI sort of realise on average over the last 10 years. I mean, however, yeah, as noted in the question, a large part of this is from the ongoing RPI reform consultation, which makes the situation somewhat more complex. With RPI potentially moving to CPIH, this would materially lower the long-run outlook for RPI, perhaps by about sort of 90 to 100 basis points. So it makes it far more nuanced for schemes. I'd say for schemes with RPI liabilities, it's likely that these changes will impact assets and liabilities in a broadly similar way, and hence the net impact will be more limited. But in reality, most schemes have at least some CPI liabilities, and CPI liabilities would not be impacted by this change, while a hedging asset would. I guess due to this, we've seen most schemes pause any further RPI hedging, and even seen a few schemes with only CPI liabilities actually reduce the level of RPI hedging that they're currently undertaking. And I think we'd say that seems sort of a sensible thing to do during this period of uncertainty. I guess the only thing I'd call out is we've also seen, I guess, an increase in the amount of sort of pure sort of CPI hedging, sort of using CPI swaps. Really, so I think it started about 12 months ago. And we had a bit of a pause in March and April when the markets were sort of largely dislocated. But we're seeing that coming back again now, sort of hedging the CPI directly like that, sort of circumvents the sort of ongoing uncertainty around RPI.
Right. Well, thanks for that, Guy. Let's go back to Sonia now to conclude. Sonia, is there anything you'd like to add before we finish up this morning?
Yes, thank you, Max. There's just very briefly two thoughts. The first one is to summarize what, again, we've discussed today. And it's very clear that we are still in between the digestion of the immediate impact of the pandemic, the digestion of the very bad economic data, and what we're hearing from companies, which is obviously counterbalanced by the enormous stimulus from governments and central banks. And I hope that with the series of calls, we were able to highlight where we do find opportunity, particularly in the current market backdrop. But as you hear, I guess, during every call, is the understanding that the longer-term implications might not yet be fully understood. And I think what we try to highlight today is obviously the resurfacing of geopolitical events that will have the potential to obviously have a major influence on the future development. What I wanted to pick out just from yesterday's announcement from Ursula von der Leyen is the fact that the EU actually has set 25% of the announced program aside for climate action. And we have highlighted ESG in the past, but it's very clear that obviously if we get a clearer alignment between government measures and climate action, ESG-related factors, that we might even see an acceleration even from a client side and within markets when it comes to this topic. So very, very interesting how they would like to link their support mechanism to so-called kind of green goals, and that's clearly something I would expect to see coming from other governments as well.
Brilliant. Well, that's a great point on which to end this week's call. I'd like to thank you, Sonia, Ed and Guy, for your time today, and I'd like to thank our clients for logging in. You can find us here in 2 weeks' time when we'll discuss our next CIO outlook, which should be hot off the press right then.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.